Yes. So today I'm going to talk to you about an ongoing research program about sort of looking at black holes and beyond GR theories of gravity, specifically dynamical Trin-Simons gravity, but some of the methods that I present here can be also used in, other beyond GR theories of gravity. And so just broadly for an outline, I'll first talk about a paper that I wrote in 2017 with Leo Stein, who was then a postdoc at Caltech, about sort of looking at the first step in looking at binary black hole mergers in dynamical Trin-Simons gravity. And this is a first step on the way to trying to produce actual binary black hole waveforms in this theory. Next, I'm going to talk about, sort of generating initial data in this theory for the actual metric or, metric perturbation, as we'll see. And specifically, a paper that I've written and sort of hope to submit soon looks sort of uses this initial data to, you always want some sort of science output for a given paper. And so looked at shadows numerically in dynamical Trin-Simons gravity. And then I'll talk about the next step in the research program, which is actually evolving, sort of metric perturbations as governed by this theory in an attempt to obtain gravitational waveforms in this theory. So first, let me broadly talk about motivations for dynamical Trin-Simons theory. So we know that general relativity is non-renormalizable, and it has kind of all these additional issues. And so at some point, at some length scale, it must fail. However, we know, for example, from the first LIGO detection that deviations from general relativity are rather small. So what we can do is use what's known as effective field theory, where we write down a classical Lagrangian, including the Einstein-Hilbert action, plus other terms that are informed by sort of an underlying quantum gravity theory. And dynamical Trin-Simons specifically, which we're going to be looking at today, has ties to sort of all these buzzwords like string theory, loop quantum gravity, canceling gravitational anomalies. So in a sense, it is motivated by quantum theories of gravity. So let's look at what the action for this theory actually looks like. So broadly, it contains a pseudoscalar field, theta, coupled to curvature via this quantity known as the Pontryagin density. And so this is just the dual of Riemann contracted with itself. And so when you look at the action, you recognize the familiar Einstein-Hilbert action here. There's a kinetic term for the scalar field. In some cases, you can consider adding a potential, but here we're just going to take, zero potential. And then you actually have a coupling, where you have a coupling between the scalar field and this Pontryagin density. So it's coupled to curvature, and it's governed by a coupling parameter. And so you can see that when, this coupling parameter is equal to zero, you recover general relativity. So in a sense, this is what's known as an effective field theory. So let's consider the equations of motion in this theory. So for the scalar field, we just get a wave equation sourced by the Pontryagin density here. But if we look at, sort of the equation governing the metric, we get the terms that are familiar to us from, regular general relativity, plus an additional term here, which unfortunately contains third derivatives of the metric. And this raises questions about, well, does this theory actually have a well-posed initial value problem? And for general relativity, it took, some time to, prove that it had a well-posed initial value problem and formulate the equations that we evolve in numerical relativity in such a way that, that was guaranteed to be well-posed. And so there are questions about, well, is this theory well posed, and can we do simulations, when you have third derivatives of the metric here? So instead, what we can consider is we know how to formulate general relativity in a well posed way. We know how to run, let's say, numerical relativity simulations. Yes.
I thought it's settled that it's not well posed.
So this paper here concluded in a sense that it's not well posed. However, there are some caveats in the paper. So I cite this paper here, and I raise this question mark here. And I sort of spoke to these authors recently at a workshop where, you know, they sort of believe that it's not well posed, but their proof still contains some, you know, additional assumptions. So for more information, there's this paper. So we know how to formulate general relativity in a well-posed way. So what we can do is we can perturb around general relativity. So we can write our metric as, you know, sort of just a standard GR background metric plus some metric perturbations governed by a power counting parameter epsilon, where epsilon counts powers of the sort of L squared coupling parameter that I showed before. And similarly with this scalar field, we're going to write it out in powers of epsilon. So, you know, let's plug into the equations of motion and collect powers. And so what we get is at zeroth order in epsilon, we recover, you know, a standard vacuum GR equation, which, you know, we know how to solve. And then for the scalar field, we have zero source. So we can take, for example, the zeroth order scalar field to be zero. Now, at first order in epsilon, the metric perturbation, owing to the fact that this scalar field is zero, has zero source, and thus we do not have a metric perturbation at this order. However, at first order, we do have a source term for the scalar field, namely the Pontryagin density here of the background. And then additionally at second order, because we have a non-zero scalar field here, we're actually going to have a source term for the metric perturbation. So what I'm going to talk about first is our results in considering this first order system and the physics that we can extract from there. And then I'll talk about generating these metric perturbations as sourced by this scalar field, which we have calculated. And looking, for example, in this paper, black hole shadows. So let's, just for an aside, talk about what was known previously about black holes and dynamical Chern-Simons gravity. So we know that Schwarzschild is a solution. However, the Kerr is not a solution and is hence modified, which is going to be important for us when we, you know, sort of talk about shadows. And we know that, for example, if we try to compute this scalar field in a slow rotation approximation, it essentially forms a dipole around an isolated black hole. Additionally, you can sort of, if you're doing, let's say, post-Newtonian theory, you can write this scalar field as having a dipole moment related to the spin. And essentially, if you look at, you know, binary black holes, you're going to have these dipoles going around each other, sourcing quadrupolar radiation in the field. Additionally, from post-Newtonian studies, and I will show comparison to these post-Newtonian studies later, we know that, you know, just looking at a decomposition in spherical harmonics, we know that the L minus 1 modes are dominant, and we know that the L equals 1 mode, at least in the in-spiral, is non-radiative, and we also expect no monopolar radiation. Yes? Yeah. So there are additional, so this is essentially talking about, So you mean dipolar radiation, wait. I'll talk about dipolar radiation in the in-spiral, and indeed, you do not see dipolar radiation in the in-spiral. However, as I will show, at the binary black hole merger, because in a sense you are forming, let's say, a scalar field which ultimately has a dipole, you do get an hitherto unknown burst of dipolar radiation. And so I'll show waveforms corresponding to that. Let us now just look at a movie of what the scalar field looks like. So let me just sort of draw out what we're seeing here. So here is sort of one black hole and another black hole, and we're going to see them going around each other. So recall that in this first order system, we have a general relativistic background. So we know how to run binary black hole simulations in general relativity. So we're essentially evolving this scalar field as sourced by a general relativistic background at first order. So what you see are sort of the scalar field around the two black holes as they're going around each other in the strong field region. And then in the far zone, we're going to see these bands of quadrupolar radiation that form. So, yes. Yes. So we can expand about any background that we want. So going back to these equations, if we look at this equation here, as long as we have a background that satisfies, the Einstein equations, we can take any background. So we don't, do a specific expansion about Kerr and Schwarzschild, even though in the literature people have, sort of done this analytically. Instead, we allow for any general relativistic background, and then, you slice it up, it evolves as a function of coordinate time. And then here, we essentially just compute the source term from this background that we are evolving to source the scalar field. So essentially, the scalar field does not back react on the GR background. So given a general GR background, so for example, this binary black hole merger, which we know how to do in numerical relativity, we can compute this source term and hence solve this evolution equation for the scalar field. Yes, so essentially here what you're seeing is, not just us imposing these dipoles, but here you're actually seeing sort of the true solution to the, equations that I showed before. So, yes. Yeah, so you have to, I'll show the waveforms, and the waveforms are just given in terms of, let's say, psi 4. Here we have a spin-aligned simulation. So we have the two black hole spins are aligned and also equal in magnitude. And so hence why you kind of see this type of profile around each of them. Because I showed earlier this dipole moment, which was related to the spin. And, if you're actually looking at, we're going to talk about scalar waves here, but, if you're actually looking at gravitational waves, you would need to, project onto some, sky location. Yes, so I will talk about that. So in the equations that we saw, you do not need to strictly throw in a coupling parameter, but in a plot that I will show later, we check what values for the coupling parameter are allowed, including at merger, such that your perturbative scheme still holds. And I'll show a figure for that. Well, PPN is sort of, PN is an expansion in, V over C, so you can't really, do that at merger. But here, because we have a full background, if we then add a small perturbation to it with a perturbative parameter, that, in a sense, makes it so effectively the metric perturbation is going to be smaller than the background metric within some tolerance. Then we can essentially, in our expansion around GR, write it as this background metric plus, a metric perturbation is governed by this parameter. Yes. Yes. Well, we know, for example, that, we know we have some, experimental evidence, not strong at this point, but for example, from, the first LIGO detection, they quote this 96%, confidence, which is leaves a lot of room. But as gravitational wave detectors get better and better, we'll, including like LISA, for example, we'll be able to better constrain just how much deviation there is from general relativity using all the methods that LIGO uses. So looking at the gravitational waveforms, We are essentially going to look at them for three simulations. So we're going to do spin 0, spin 0.1, and spin 0.3. You know, in theory, you can do this for any spin. These are just kind of, you know, simpler to run than a spin 0.9999. And so what we see here is I've plotted, you know, psi 4, specifically the dominant 2-2 mode, which, you know, is going to be a proxy for the gravitational radiation, let's say. And here I've plotted the L minus 1 modes of the radiation, because recall from post-Newtonian theory, we know that these are the dominant modes, and indeed we confirm this in our simulation. So for the spin 0 case, recall that Schwarzschild is a solution, so you essentially see no radiation until, you know, you get to merger, because, for example, we know that two Schwarzschild black holes merging are going to form, let's say, something with a spin. Whereas in the spinning cases, you know, we actually see radiation in, let's say, the 2-1 and 3-2 modes during the n spiral. And here in the dashed line, I apologize that this blue line is hard to see. That's our actual numerical solution. But this dashed line is a post-Newtonian prediction. And so you see that we agree with the post-Newtonian prediction until ultimately the post-Newtonian prediction fails, and we sort of only show the numerical solution. In part, an interesting thing that we see is this burst of dipolar radiation at merger, which was hitherto unknown in post-Newtonian theory. And so similarly to the spin 0.1 that I showed on the previous slide, you know, I'm also going to show results for spin 0.3. So, yes. Yes.
So I'm trying to compare this 0-0 and 0-1, how much bigger, because the scales keep changing. I'm not sure. Is it spin enhances the amount of radiation?
So the spin does enhance the amount of radiation. I will show plots where on the same plot I compare various values for the spin, but I mean you sort of get a trade-off with how clearly you can see the waveform for a given, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, a good, that's true. A good figure to include would be sort of all, you know, a mode for all the spins, but, you know, we'll see. So, you know, here in this first paper that we wrote, you know, we haven't yet looked at metric perturbations. Instead, we've just looked at the scalar field. However, there are kind of interesting results that we can learn from, you know, at least this step of the program. And so, for example, kind of going back to what Luis was saying about comparing the values of the spins, we can compute proxies for the energy flux in, let's say, GR plus the energy flux due to the stress energy tensor of this scalar field. And so what we see is here is just kind of the gravitational flux as predicted by, as given by numerical relativity. And here we have the flux associated with the scalar field. So you see that as you increase spin, you get more and more energy flux. And in a sense, you can kind of say, well, you know, as I increase spin, you know, the amount of, you know, radiation that I have in the scalar field, or let's say energy flux that I have in the scalar field increases. And so I should maybe see larger modifications to, you know, the actual behavior of, let's say, the metric perturbation that's sourced by this. And we do a comparison with the post-Newtonian case. However, we include all modes of this radiation, whereas the post-Newtonian case only includes some of them. So, you know, there's a slight deviation, but, you know, we sort of explained that. Well, you can think about it at, well, you know, you can think about it as, you know, that you have a scalar field dipole moment, let's say in you know, some approximation that's governed by the spin. And so as you increase spin, you increase, let's say, the strength of the scalar field. And so, it, you know, in that sense, you see, you know, more energy flux there. Additionally, you can think about, no, so we actually start with dipolar initial data for the scalar field. And I will talk about, later, I will talk about actually solving for, let's say, the metric perturbation given this dipolar scalar field as well. No, the dipole is governed by the spin, and so we start with that. Mm-hmm.
But also, at merge, right? In spin, also you throw higher curvature.
Yeah. Right? Because you're, at well, at merge.
Vibrating, I think it's closer. So the source of the curve is well, then the curvature, because the curvature is higher for speed. So that would be the source. The inspire, L parameter.
If it's a small,
you have a parameter.
Just make it a small.
Well, you have a parameter that controls everything. So here I've sort of, yeah, there's no back reaction. So here I've essentially written this all in terms of, let's say, some power of this parameter. So if you were really to, you know, sort of actually have a, you know, a meaningful scale for this, you would have to plug in, you know, some value for this parameter. And indeed, let us talk about appropriate values for this parameter. So we can talk about, you know, recall that we're doing a perturbative scheme around general relativity. In part, you know, we're taking a GR background metric plus some metric perturbation. And so in order for, you know, this to actually be perturbative, we need the size of this to, you know, obviously be smaller than the size of this. And we can compute, you know, some, let's say, maximum allowed quantity by, you know, just taking, you know, sort of a ratio between these. And since we only have the scalar field in this study, and I'll show later kind of similar things for the metric perturbation, we have an approximation that allows us to, in a sense, quantify, let's say, the amplitude of this metric perturbation here, given the scalar field. But what we can do is throughout the entire simulation, we can see this, we can track this allowed parameter. And so here in this plot, I've shown the three spins that we consider. And for each case, the region, let's say, above it, for each of these like hashings, is where perturbation theory is invalid because, you know, this is as governed by this parameter, whereas below it, this is where perturbation theory is roughly valid. And so you see that for larger spins, you run into sort of a tighter constraint on this coupling parameter. And then at merger, they all have roughly the sort of a similar spin. And so you see that, you know, here for this single black hole that's, you know, ringing down, you have this kind of sort of a regime of validity. So when you're actually, so all the figures that I've shown are, you know, given in terms of powers of this coupling parameter. So if you have a value for this coupling parameter and you want to get actual, you know, physical results out of this, you have to first make sure that it's consistent with your perturbative scheme. And second, you can sort of put it into all these plots that I'll show so that, you know, you get sort of actual values. So for example, yes. Yeah, so the details of this are given in our paper. We roughly say that it's governed by the stress energy tensor of the scalar field. So there is a... Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'll show a plot for this for actual metric perturbations that I compute right now around a single black hole, but this is easily extendable to the binary case as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Differential operator acting on
each
two.
Yes. No. So you get you essentially get just what is it called, like an Einstein type operator. So you have a second order operator there. I should have stressed when I was going through the order reduction scheme that at each order, when you look at the metric perturbation, you recover something that's metric perturbation, you recover something that's governed by just a standard, like, you know, second order Einstein type operator. And so in a sense, you know how to solve an equation of this type. There are no derivatives higher than 2. Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's right at the horizon to the point where so all these little jumps that you see, and this is like kind of a numerical relativity aside, are because we exclude all in our spectral scheme, where you exclude all the collocation points outside of the apparent horizon, because this is really only meaningful outside of the apparent horizon. And these jumps you see are due to adaptive mesh refinement close to the horizon. So indeed it is sort of precisely close to the horizon that you get. I mean, and that kind of makes sense because you have like maximal curvature there and stuff. So mm-hmm. Yes.
This is a mirror. Somehow, if you avoid right, some kind of mathematical magic.
Yeah, so all the magic is given kind of in detail in our paper. So that might be easier to look at than, you know, because I mean, all the stuff that I'm presenting here is kind of like schematic right now. So, if you'd like to look at it. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, and I'll talk about kind of what this allows us to do in terms of. Actually being able to constrain this parameter with LIGO observations. So that's a result that I'll show a little later on. So in addition, so here this is kind of a local, let's say, breakdown of your perturbative scheme. You know, on each time slice, you look at this kind of quantity, but additionally, you also get a global breakdown, because what's happening is because you are evolving this scalar field on a binary black hole background as governed by general relativity with no back reaction, what happens is the end spiral that would otherwise happen, let's say if you were to, you know, really do this in, you know, of a full theory with dynamical transignments, you kind of would expect the end spiral to happen faster. But because you are evolving on a GR background whose, you know, sort of end spiral is purely governed by GR, you kind of have a little bit of an inconsistency. And so you need to additionally be careful about the amount of, let's say, dephasing that you're going to get from the fact that you are, you know, evolving on a GR background with no back reaction. And so in the paper, we also put estimates on the amount of dephasing that you get. So I won't go into this right now, but essentially what we do is we produce a result where for each spin, according to some reference time, so here we've picked a time, you know, roughly corresponding to, I forget what this is, like apparent horizon formation or something, where we sort of quantify, kind of going away from this time, the amount of dephasing that you get. But recall that here, you know, I've kind of divided out this coupling parameter. So really what you have to do is you kind of say, well, this is how much dephasing I can tolerate. What kind of value for the coupling parameter for some region that I'm interested in looking at sort of allows for this dephasing tolerance? So for example, we can ask ourselves, well, how long does it take to accumulate a radian of phase difference? And so for example, you know, according to some alignment time, you see that for lower spin, you can kind of go for, let's say, longer if you, you know, start here and then you ask yourself, how long does it take to accumulate a radian of phase difference? Whereas for, you know, higher spin, it takes less time. So let us actually kind of, you know, let's say we have, yes. Yes. So this is all using the chain rule. So you essentially say, okay, my dephasing is going to be expanded, you know, in time, you know, with respect to some reference time. So assuming you're close to your reference time, kind of in a thing like this. And then this, I think, can actually be scaled out. It just corresponds to like a rescaling of the mass. And then you end up with kind of a chain rule term here, and this, excuse me, a term here, and this we compute using like a long kind of chain rule calculation where we take, you know, this can be written in terms of the energy flux, and we have our estimates for the energy flux, and so here, yeah.
Now a secular break.
Yes. Yes. So here, it's kind of like written into here. So this is the amount of dephasing that you get at some time. So you kind of get this, you know, leading order quadratic dephasing, let's say. And so here, this shows up, so let's say the amount of dephasing with respect to some reference time shows up here as a power of L to the minus 4. And in this plot, where you can ask yourself, well, let's say I start, you know, let's say I set this as my reference time, how long can I evolve for until I accumulate, well, sort of what is this kind of secular drifting time? And the power that you get in here is kind of an L squared thing. So essentially we're multiplying by this in order to kind of get rid of like this in the calculation. So it is kind of a, I guess, a 1/ epsilon thing. But, you know, sort of the details of all of this are in the paper about how we do this calculation. I didn't put anything too, you know, I didn't put any of the equations here because I just wanted to kind of generally talk.
Sorry, so
yes. It's this kind of secular dephasing where your solution, because you're evolving on a GR background without back reaction, drifts from what it would kind of otherwise be if you were to, let's say, evolve in the full theory. And so this is essentially what we mean by dephasing. So yes. So in this calculation that I showed in the previous plot, this is all calculated with the scalar radiation. So we can ask ourselves, well, okay, so recall that we have this, you know, it's just the thing we started with, which is our, you know, dynamical Chern-Simons action. We can ask ourselves, okay, well, what are the current bounds on this parameter? And so this parameter has dimensions of length. And what you can think about is, you know, when this parameter goes to zero, you know, this theory becomes purely classical GR. And so essentially it tells you about kind of a scale below which let's say, quantum effects may be important. So, for example, from actual, let's say, calculations from Gravity Probe B and I don't know how to pronounce this, the Lagios satellites, you can bound this parameter to 10 to the 8th kilometers. And from, let's say, projections using post-Newtonian waveforms, so those waveforms that I showed before that I was comparing to, you can say, well, okay, if LIGO sees an event that is consistent with general relativity to this type of tolerance and, you know, the in spiral because it's PN, we can potentially bound this parameter to 10 to, let's say, 100 kilometers forward, you know, the kind of masses that LIGO expects to see. And, you know, we can ask ourselves, okay, well, what bound could we potentially place? And I won't go through this in too much detail, but we essentially say, well, let's kind of consider an event with, I don't know, spins of 0.3, I mean, and a total mass, like, let's say, 60 times the mass of the sun, so kind of in line with the first LIGO detection. And we show that, let's say, if you tolerate an error in the phase of, let's say, 0.1 radians within, you know, kind of the wave that you can see in your sort of detector bucket, we can bound it also to order like 10 kilometers. This number 11 is very specific, but let's say 10. So these were, yes?
Some of those are upper limits, some are lower limits. I don't know.
Which ones are upper limits?
What is the lower limit?
Oh. I think, don't pay attention. I just flipped. Sorry, this was a typo. Okay. I apologize. So,
yeah. Go back
to Yes, it is. Indeed. So you do have to be very careful with that, and that is, in the sort of conclusion of this paper, we talk about sort of doing that as a later study, but indeed you have, you know, this is a strong assumption here in this calculation. And so here I talked about, you know, so far I talked about this sort of first order in epsilon, but now we can consider, you know, this second order in epsilon thing where we actually have a sourced metric perturbation. And so what I'm going to be talking about is essentially generating metric perturbation initial data. Now, this is like second order, but because we have, you know, zero here, in a sense, this is kind of the leading correction. So we can do, let's say, linear perturbation theory, where we can write our metric as a background metric plus this as governed by some coupling parameter, and then just do, let's say, perturbation theory in that. So I'll talk about broadly generating initial data. So in this paper that I've written that I hope to put out soon, oh, I apologize, it's hard to see the colors. I have this like blue background and everything. I talk about a sort of formalism for being able to generate, let's say, first order metric perturbation initial data, so numerically on any given background with any sort of boundary conditions that you like with any source that you like. I mean, provided like, you know, all these assumptions of smoothness and blah, blah, blah. So this is kind of an extension of the extended conformal thin sandwich formalism, which is used in most cases to generate initial data in numerical relativity. In particular for, you know, binary black holes, this is used to generate initial data. And so you have some, let's say, free data that goes into it. I won't go into too much detail, but essentially you kind of solve for, let's say, metric data, so on the initial slice, so let's say you're a spatial metric and your extrinsic curvature by performing this kind of conformal scaling where you recast your sort of, you know, favorite 3 plus 1 ADM equations in a way that you know, specify some of what's known as free data, you impose some boundary conditions, and then out of it, you get a lapse, a shift, and then a conformal metric, which you then a conformal factor, which you then multiply by this kind of conformal metric that you've put here to get the spatial metric. So essentially, you get your, let's say, full space-time metric using the extended conformal thin sandwich formalism. And in this paper, I use a perturbed version of this, where I, you know, similarly, you can specify some perturbed free data, and then out of it, you can get a perturbed lapse, sort of a leading order perturbation to your lapse, your shift, and your conformal factor, from which you can then, you know, sort of reconstruct your sort of perturbed, your first order metric perturbation. Yes? I don't think so. I think, are you asking about like unique solutions or? Well, I mean, this is all, if you look at the equations, this is all just second order operators. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Sorry? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so this is just forgetting, you know, even dynamical Chern Simons. Let's sort of not. Can everybody see that? It's kind of faint. You know, sort of just forgetting. Just forgetting about dynamical Chern Simons in the first place. I mean, let us just write, you know, a metric perturbation like this. We know we have a system of, you know, equations which are roughly, you know, second order for this metric, and then, you know, you just plug in your linearized equation here, and then you recover, let's say, just a set of, you know, you recover a set of PDEs for this guy. Let me just make this the spatial metric. I apologize. There's GIJs throughout. You know. Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, so the we know how to construct, you know, scalar field solutions. So what do you essentially get in this extended conformal thin sandwich formalism is for, you know, from this, you know, theta here, you can get, you know, perturbed quantities that then feed into, you know, your recast, you know, Hamiltonian momentum constraints plus your evolution equation for the extrinsic curvature. But this is kind of fully general, and, you know, we can also, you know, so it doesn't even matter what, you know, theory applies, you apply it to, as long as you can, whoops, you know, and this is kind of useful for, you know, potentially additional studies where, let's say you know, just on Kerr or something, you compare nonlinear versus linear perturbations, you know, something like this. So now let me talk about how you do this in dynamical Chern Simons gravity. So recall that the second order metric perturbation has a source, but because the first order metric perturbation vanishes, I'm just going to call this my sort of metric perturbation. So essentially what we're doing is something like, so I'll just write it like this for now, and this is epsilon squared. So for, you know, for the source, you need some initial data for the scalar field, and we take our initial data from a paper that Leo wrote where he numerically generates initial data for the field that is valid for all spins. And so this is kind of useful to us, so we use this and then generate all of our source terms for these perturbed extended conformal thin sandwich equations. And so, you know, this is numerical relativity, so you have to check that your data satisfies some constraint equations. And in part, if you take the standard Hamiltonian and momentum constraints and you perturb them, you get perturbed, sorry, Hamiltonian momentum constraints that your metric perturbation must obey. And so here I've just shown, you know, some, you know, normalized norm of the constraint. as a function of domain resolution. So in our case, we use a spectral code. And so as you increase the domain resolution by a constant factor, so just throwing in, let's say, a constant number of collocation points, you see exponential convergence in these constraints. Now, we know that for higher spins, because, you know, this is done on a Kerr-Schild background, because this thing starts to kind of like pancake, you need more and more collocation points to be able to resolve something like this, which is why this has a slower convergence and requires more domain resolution to get to the same amount of constraint violation as you do for lower spins. And this can be, and in the paper, we sort of outline how to choose boundary conditions. This is all solving for, let's say, a single black hole sourced by, you know, sort of the first order scalar field. And we talk about what sort of boundary conditions you need to pick to get stationary initial data. And this can be generalized to the binary case because the boundary conditions that we impose are just perturbations of standard horizon boundary conditions. So if you say, you know, I have some, you know, in our case, what we do is we have our outer domain boundary condition. And so we can just say, you know, let's do zero metric perturbation there because we don't have any sort of source term. And then what happens is in our code, we also excise the singularities and we excise them based on the apparent horizon so that you don't get, you know, assuming this is close to the event horizon so that, you know, just making sure that you don't get any incoming characteristics here because that would kind of spoil everything. So we need to specify boundary conditions along here, and initially you specify conditions which correspond to setting the expansion to be zero and setting your, your conditions on your shift, for example, because recall that we solved for this in this scheme, such that you recover a spin which corresponds to, let's say, the spin that you would like to put on this black hole. And so similarly, this can be sort of easily generalized to the binary case, where instead of just imposing one such condition, you're imposing two because you have two boundaries, and then you're kind of globally solving in this case. And then for the scalar field, you can just do a superposition of these types of solutions. I mean, that's kind of what we did in the binary evolution case. So provided you have large enough separation, you're allowed to do this. And so now that we actually have a metric perturbation that we have solved for, let's consider the regime of validity. So recall again that we are comparing, we are asking ourselves, well, how valid is our perturbative scheme? And so essentially we're asking ourselves about the size of this compared to the size of this. So within some, you know, constant that you can throw in and, you know, you kind of take a ratio of the norms of these things and you find the, let's say, extrema of this ratio on your domain, you get a figure that kind of looks like this. And I apologize, it's hard to see. This is all kind of blue below this line, where these are values of this coupling parameter that are allowed by perturbation theory. And then these are values that are not allowed. Yes.
So this is, I mean, the comparison of these is not a gauge invariant comparison.
Yes. Yes.
So
I will talk about why we still need to know this. So this is in itself is not really a result, but I will talk about generating black hole shadows. And in order to generate these black hole shadows, you actually reconstruct, let's say, this metric, which is your background metric, plus this perturbation, and you need to throw in, you know, an actual value for this perturbative parameter. Now, the output that you get out of it, because it's the black hole shadow, that's gauge invariant. But when putting this metric in to be able to trace null geodesics in the spacetime, you need something that in your simulation is consistent with, you know, being in a perturbative regime. I will show. Oh, I apologize. I haven't done the conversion to L here. This is just this type of epsilon here. So I haven't, you know, put in any kind of physical things. I mean, there's like Planck mass factors in there and stuff. So I apologize that that's not done.
So there was a paper
Yes. 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 Yeah. So that's I talked to, this was someone in Nico Yunus's group. Well, so there are two papers. There was one that sort of did it in a fully nonlinear scheme, and they compared to previous results from sort of analytical like perturbation theory, and they found that, you know, they kind of in sort of low values of this coupling parameter, they were able to, you know, sort of recover this, you know, first order expansion. And then additionally, there was a study by you know, the group at Montana State University that generated sort of these solutions in a post-Newtonian type expansion, and then they also looked at the shadow. And so I've talked to Nico about comparing with sort of his group. So we're going to talk about black hole shadows. So essentially, these are physical observables. So that's you know, quite nice to have something that's, you know, gauge independent for once. And essentially the way that you find a shadow in practice is you evolve null geodesics in the space-time and then ask yourselves, well, you know, I have some, let's say, what's called a camera. So I start these geodesics, you know, somewhere here. Let's say here's the black hole. And I evolve these geodesics backwards in time, and I ask myself, well, okay, which ones converge on, you know, the surface, or which ones make it out to infinity? And so, in a sense, that gives you this, these ones that converge, in a sense, give you the edge of the black hole shadow. So in order to do this, I used the SXS collaboration lensing codes. This is the code that was, you know, used to generate all these like pretty what would a black hole look like pictures. So, you know, why do something like this? So, you know, we have the Event Horizon Telescope, which can resolve to, let's say, sub-horizon scales, Sagittarius A star, which is the black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy, and additionally, hopefully, the black hole at the center of the M87 galaxy. Now, you know, we can look at sort of these numerical values for the black hole shadows that we get out of the simulations all we want, but really we have to consider, well, you know, how well can, you know, the Event Horizon Telescope actually perform, and that will kind of inform, you know, kind of are we even able to detect these sort of Chern-Simons deviations with the Event Horizon Telescope. So this is a figure reproduced from this paper by Saltis et al, where they perform this type of analysis where they look at the black hole spin and the black hole quadrupole moment inferred from Event Horizon Telescope data, with mock data. And so you get, you know, for Kerr, you have this kind of relationship between these two quantities, right? And so you get this kind of curve line here. And so any deviation from that can essentially, you know, can essentially tell you, you know, you're sort of deviating away from the general relativistic prediction. Now, from the black, just looking at the black hole shadow with the Event Horizon Telescope, you get quite a spread in what you could potentially recover. But looking at, for example, the orbits of stars around, I think this was Sagittarius A star, for some, you know, mock value of the spin and hence the quadrupole moment, you know, in GR, and also looking at the behavior of pulsars, you can get kind of a tighter constraint. But this constraint is still quite potentially weak. And so I'm going to be looking at, let's say, spins. Yes, yes, yes. So in theory, if there were pulsars, yes. So here, you know, this is, in this study, it was chosen to have a spin of 0.6. And you kind of see with these additional observations, you can kind of have, you know, a bound of around 0.1. And so I'm going to be considering, you know, what happens to the shadow if you're kind of in this regime and then you change the spin. So let's look at what the shadow looks like in dynamical Trim-Simons gravity. So, Yes. They make so I think it's more of a 90% claim. So you excuse me, a 9% claim. So you can make. Oh, it's changed. Okay. So from 5 to 9. So this claim I think is due to the fact that you have this in just for NGR, you kind of have this relationship between the mass and the distance. And so if you see that this shadow has an angular scale consistent with the distance, in a sense, that you measure to, let's say, Sagittarius A star, you have a constraint. And it was 9% before, but I guess it's 5% now. Sorry?
Very.
Oh, yeah. Very. Yeah. But, I mean, order of magnitude. So, yeah.
But if I'm thinking of what dynamical Trim-Simons is doing, mm-hmm. So it has a coupling with the curvature.
Yeah.
I also would expect to see the scale of the mass of black hole.
Yes. Yes, yes. So I will talk about that in a second. So, yes, indeed. So here I'm just going to just show you. Let me actually start with what I was saying before. So suppose you have some edge that's reconstructed from the Event Horizon Telescope. So let's say maybe this has, you know, a little. This is bad. let's say you have some edge, right? And Saltis et al. Have a paper where they talk about an actual procedure that they can use from Event Horizon Telescope data to generate such an edge, you know, to a given precision. Now, what you can do is, you know, let us immediately find the axis of symmetry here. You know, for Schwarzschild, just take whatever axis, but you don't anticipate a deviation from, you know, a GCS correction anyway. But let us just immediately find the axis of reflection symmetry here. Then what we can do is just write a kind of decomposition, you know, just kind of decompose this shape into a set of multiple moments, but where, you know, throughout I'll sort of show functions that look like this, but there are things that you have to keep in mind. First of all, you have to be very careful about where you center this angle, because what you don't want is to say, well, you know, I have this perfectly spherical black hole. I'm going to draw this angle out like this. And then suddenly you're going to have all these spurious multiples due to the fact that you've just picked the wrong origin. And so what we do is we ask ourselves, you know, kind of to just be consistent across all of the sort of spins that we look at, is we ask ourselves for a center here that minimizes, you know, kind of, let's say, the leading coefficient. So this, like, F2 coefficient. And so here we sort of see it attain a minimum, let's say, around this value. And so you know in this sense that this non-zero value that you see here, and this is for a spin of a 0.9 black hole, is you know, not due to, is due, let's say, just to the spin. And now additionally, you know, the shadow is going to have like a size associated with it, but this is also not physically meaningful because this is going to, first of all, correspond to the distance to the shadow, and then also correspond to, you know, it's going to have some dependence on the mass. And so indeed, this these first coefficients, so kind of like F1 here, actually, if you normalize everything by that coefficient, you normalize out the mass. And so now you have, let's say, a fit for the shape of the shadow that is only dependent on spin and any additional, let's say, epsilon squared deviation parameter that you introduce. So two parameters. So here I've shown the normalized fit, so already normalizing out by the size, already centering everything according to the prescription that I talked about. And so really what I'm interested in is this kind of spin of 0.6, because this is what Saltis et al. Did. Now, of course, as you go into a higher spin, you can see, oh, well, you know, I'm going to get more deviation. But for the purpose of comparing to their study, let me consider a spin of 0.6. So this is kind of what you see. This is all difficult to see, right? But here, this black line where I've zoomed in here and then here corresponds to the shadow with this spin of 0.6. Now, let me introduce a DCS perturbation. So let me pick, you know, this kind of value of epsilon squared, which is the maximal value allowed by the regime of validity that, you know, we calculated before. So, you know, you can't go any bigger because then your perturbation scheme breaks down. And so indeed, you do see a deviation. Now, let me say, well, okay, so I saw in the Saltis et al. Paper that you kind of get a spread of 0.1 in estimating the spin with the Event Horizon Telescope. So what happens if, you know, instead of introducing a DCS deviation, I sort of shift, let's say, the spin of 0.7, and you see this kind of, let's say, deviation in the shape of the shadow here, and then just for reference on this plot, I've included 0.9. I mean, so the radius corresponding to the size, in a sense, you scale it out, because if you're just looking with the Event Horizon Telescope, things like the location aren't meaningful, and then things of corresponding to the size aren't really meaningful, especially when you do something like this, especially these, you know, sort of camera coordinates aren't, you know, actually meaningful. They're just, you know, you are just looking at the structure of the shape of the thing. Now you can associate, let's say, a mass and a distance to this thing, and then you get, you know, a different angular size. But in a sense, this just corresponds to, you know, roughly changing the mass, changing the distance. And so that isn't, you know, really super important for our purposes of testing GR, unless you were doing this, you know, sort of angular size check test. Yes. You do. But here I'm sort of more concerned. Well, I mean, you have to throw in it. So, for example, the Event Horizon Telescope can do like micro arc second resolution in the sky, and so you expect, let's say, I think an order 10 micro arc seconds for Sagittarius A star, but I haven't. Yeah. Oh, okay. So I haven't looked at. Yeah. So in this study, I'm more kind of interested in seeing what happens to the shape, let's say.
So
yeah. Well, we're going to look at that in one plot later. So, well, I already talked about this. And so essentially what you can do is, so the two dominant multipole moments, once you normalize out by this sort of overall shape of the shadow, are the n equals 2, 1, and the n equals 3, 1, let's say. So we're just going to look at these two, and then also, you know, numerically, they're the most sort of well-resolved, so they're kind of good to look at. And here I've shown for values of spin of 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, the dashed line corresponds to the sort of epsilon is equal to zero value. So the values of these multiple moments when it's sort of unperturbed, and, you know, these values, you know, have a special value in Kerr, and so you can kind of do a consistency check between these two. And then when I introduce epsilon, you see that up to, you know, kind of a value allowed by the regime of validity, you see that you deviate from this prediction. Now, it's true that you have this kind of mapping that for a given spin and epsilon, you can map it onto, you know, these multipoles, but then, you know, according to your degeneracy question, you have to ask yourself, okay, well, how do I go in the other direction? Is this map actually invertible? So one thing that we can potentially look at And I've sort of presented this figure within the kind of tolerances that the Saltis paper allows. So here we essentially have this F2, F3 plane. Now, for Kerr, all of this is governed by the spin. And so you get this kind of curve here, which is purely parameterized by spin. And here I've plotted, you know, the actual values of these numerically for my sort of epsilon is equal to zero simulations. Now, and I fit this across all spins, but here just zoomed in on 0.5 to 0.7. Chi is, so it depends on how you define things. So in this case, I have defined chi to be the background spin. Now, you know that if you were to introduce a Chern-Simons deviation, you would have to, you would in a sense get a modification to the location of the apparent horizon and shape, and hence a modification to the spin that you would measure from there, let's say from, you know, an axial killing vector, an approximate killing vector type analysis. Now, because that deviation is purely parameterized in terms of epsilon, you can potentially reparameterize all of this in terms of your epsilon and your the spin that you measure when you perform this deviation. Here I've presented everything in terms of epsilon and the background spin, but you can certainly, and it might be more physically meaningful to actually perform this map and present everything in terms of that. But we can ask ourselves, so kind of zooming in here now, so this is, you know, now of order 0.02, which is less than kind of what we saw in the Saltis et al. Paper, we can ask ourselves, well, for each of these values of spin where, you know, here I just plot the value that for these multiple moments that you get in Kerr, well, what happens when I introduce a, you know, sort of a perturbation? So here, the stars, you know, for each color show the values of these multiples when you introduce a perturbation of that strength. And what you see is this is kind of the line that I showed here corresponding to the like Kerr as parameterized just by the spin. And you sort of see a deviation from this line. Now, from this figure, you can also kind of, you know, garner that it is going to be hard, especially since this is such a strong perturbation, it is going to be hard to precisely pinpoint what the epsilon and chi are. But something like this allows you to perform a, let's say, a null hypothesis type test because you see a deviation from these otherwise predicted values from GR when you introduce this kind of deviation. So you can at least perform a null hypothesis test and, you know, place a bound on epsilon, because as you decrease epsilon, you know, the closer you get to this curve. But so these error bars are my error, these are my error bars as generated by, well, they're kind of extended, but they're just, I shouldn't have included those. Yeah. So you see that I don't think the Event Horizon Telescope has enough resolution to be able to measure a distance like this. And so in that sense, currently, this is going to be very difficult to measure. But, you know, something like this, you can kind of move forward with it. And, you know, this, you know, at least you can generate initial data for the binary problem. So even though this is kind of hopeless, you can at least do that. And indeed, for next steps, you know, you can use this whole formalism to generate kind of, yeah. True. Yeah. True. That's true. No. And so, you know, sort of talking about next steps in this program. So I talked about how to generate metric perturbation initial data. I haven't presented it here, but, you know, just imposing the same kinds of boundary conditions at large separations, you can just generate initial data for a binary problem. And then, you know, the key is to then evolve this metric perturbation. And so I have what I'm sort of working on right now is, you know, being able to, you know, I've sort of written a whole scheme based on the generalized harmonic formalism of general relativity to evolve these metric perturbations in, let's say, a convergent way. So what I show here as just a sort of a test that I've done so far with my code, where I just take, let's say, sort of no black holes in the space-time, I just take, you know, a sort of a multipolar wave, I apply a coordinate transformation to it to sort of turn on the most possible number of terms. And then what you can see is, for example, here are, you know, various constraints. And so as you increase resolution, you can see kind of constraint convergence. This is, you know, sort of coordinate time of the simulation. And then moreover, you can compute what the metric perturbation looks like. So here you're actually computing a metric perturbation waveform. And so you can see that, first of all, the metric perturbation waveform is convergent with itself. It's convergent with an analytical solution. And I mean, this is just schematically what it looks like. And so, you know, I have code that can, you know, evolve these types of metric perturbations. Now, however, I haven't yet done it for the binary case, but given, yes. Yes. So this is not even for a single black hole. This is just a multipolar wave. This is like the baseline test that you would do for this type of code. The analytical solution is just a multipolar wave. So you write down a known, let's say, so you can write down what a multipolar wave looks like on your domain as a function of time. So this is, I mean, something that you can write down. Yes. So essentially what you do is you take... Okay. So in the generalized harmonic formalism, and we do a first order formalism, what you are evolving is an equation for the metric perturbation. And that equation has an operator, which essentially has the same principal part as, you know, the sort of standard generalized harmonic operator for metric perturbation. This is unsourced here.
Oh, okay.
But you can, in the generalized harmonic formalism, you can also include a source in the equations. I mean, people do this with like... Yes. So the key is to put the source from the scalar field and then use the binary initial data that I have and then evolve everything. But I've kept this fully general, so you can throw...
Yes.
Okay, yeah, let's do that. And then we can throw out the whole project. So. So indeed, sort of what I described now is, you know, sort of the next step in my program, which I hope to, you know, continue this year and then, you know, when I'm a postdoc and stuff. So thank you very much for listening. Sorry, I Well, you have parity violation in the theory.
There's a fixed vector. That's Thomas Soterio.
Yes, you said that the actual variation wave takes the order of magnitude of the parameter L, like take a lot of the cell in the space. And then you said there are like three variations of the parameter. So, how is the expectation of like how large that would be? Very far away.
So I think that the overall question that you kind of ask here is can you see quantum gravity effects on these scales? Because, you know, black holes and specifically binary black holes are kind of the strongest, you know, general relativistic laboratory that we have. And so if you cannot see quantum gravity effects there, you know, then you kind of raise the question of, well, how do you test these, you know, sort of theories in the first place? And so, you know, these constraints are still, you know, kind of quite weak. I mean, they depend on, for example, the amount of dephasing error that LIGO can see. So, for example, as I showed before in that equation, the less dephasing error that you see, and if you know LIGO can perfectly phase a general relativity waveform with detector data and the limit of, you know, infinite signal to noise ratio, then you essentially bound this parameter to zero. So, I mean, there is as you improve SNR. So, for example, something like LISA with supermassive black holes would be better at, you know, constraining something like this. As you decrease your phasing error, the better you can bound this parameter, because the better you can say, you know, I don't see any quantum gravity effects. I agree, you know, my data agrees with a GR null hypothesis. That's a good question. I have to look that up. I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah, I'm not like a string theorist or anything.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes, it has dimension and doubling.
I would imagine that because it has a dimension, so it's probably easier to test and examine with its smaller particles.
Yes. 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 So LISA kind of ruins that, but yeah.
So that's why.
And the event horizon. Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, you do what you can. So. Thank you.